On the Cimarron, November 27th, 1890. The next morning during breakfast, Dusty suddenly put his tin plate down, then got up and walked several feet away from the wagons and the campfire. He stood there for a long moment, looking toward the ragged top of a bluff marking the western boundary of the prairie.
Say, what's gotten into Dusty?
I don't know, but whatever it is, I got a feeling it's not gonna be good.
After a few minutes, Dusty came back to the others.
Boss, we got us a fire. I can smell it.
What? Where?
I think it's on this side of the river, and it's west of us, which means it'll be coming this way.
He's right. Look.
Matt pointed to the west, and there, faintly visible, was a cloud of light brown smoke mixed in with the haze.
Maybe it's just a morning fog.
It's a fire, and a big one. Look, you can see the smoke from there all the way down to there.
Smoke pointed out the parameters of the approaching fire.
We better start a backfire if we want to keep it away from the herd.
Setting a backfire big enough to stop the oncoming flames would be quite an effort. It might have been easier if everyone could do it, but Clay knew that he would have to hold at least two people back to keep an eye on the herd. He gave that assignment to Matt and Dalton, then told the others to come with him to fight the fire.
I think we should keep Maria back with the wagons.
No, Maria can do her part. We're going to need every hand.
Clay, you, more than anyone, should understand why she must stay behind.
Yes, you're right. She should stay behind.
I will stay by the river. That way, I can keep some sacks wet for you.
Yeah, that's a good idea. We'll need wet sacks to control the flames of the backfire, to keep them going in the right direction.
With improvised torches, Clay and the others crossed a shallow coulee and began setting fire to the tangled brown mat which covered the ground just on the other side. The men were setting the fires while Sally and Rebecca followed slowly behind them carrying wet sacks, making certain that the flames did not blow back across the ditch. They had barely gotten the backfire started when a jagged line of fire with an upper wall of tumbling brown smoke leaped into view at the top of the bluff.
Smoke?
It's closer than I thought it was.
We've got one thing in our favor. There's less grass on the hillside than there is down here.
Aye, and on some places there's no grass at all.
When the fire reached those places, it would not be able to leap over, but would have to move around. They had one more advantage. The fire was burning noticeably slower coming down a hill than it did while it was on level ground. But even that advantage was somewhat offset by the fact that there were a few long, narrow ditches that ran to the top of the bluff, and they were filled with dry brush. Those long seams would act as flues, drawing the fire down them as easily as flame following a wick. Rebecca, in turning to extinguish a new outbreak of flames behind her, inadvertently swept her skirt across a clump of burning grass and set it aflame. Because she was intent upon her work, running from one outbreak of flame to another, and with the smoke and smell of fire all about her, she was totally unaware of what had happened. Tom saw it, and moving quickly, he wrapped a wet sack around her.
Tom, what are you doing?
Your dress was on fire.
Rebecca looked down to inspect the damage done to her dress. When she looked up again, her face was pale.
Are you all right?
Oh, yes, I'm fine, thank you. You saved my life, didn't you?
I wouldn't go that far, but I might have kept you from getting a painful burn.
Rebecca put her arms around his neck to steady herself. As she did so, their lips came together. Rebecca was pleasantly surprised by the kiss, and she reacted to it with a heat that thrilled her to her soul. The kiss went on much longer than she would have thought, until finally it was Tom who broke it off.
Well, I'm sorry. I had no right to do that.
Oh, Tom, you have every right. Don't you know that?
We should get back to the camp.
Indian Territory, December 5th, 1890. The day after the fire, as they were having their breakfast, they were surprised to look up and see an Indian, his face lined with age and wizened with experience. Clay recognized the man as Ashke. He had met him on one of his previous cattle drives. The Indian was standing less than 10 feet away.
Ashke, I see that you're still able to walk like a bird.
You did not hear?
I did not.
You did not see me?
I did not.
I am old. Still, I can walk like a warrior.
Would you like some breakfast?
Coffee.
Sally poured a cup of coffee and handed it to him. Ashke looked out at the herd. He pointed to the cattle.
Are they buffalo?
Buffalo? No, they aren't buffalo. Ask you, you've been around buffalo all your life. You know that this isn't buffalo.
It is being said that you are taking buffalo from our land. There are many who want to make trouble for you, but I told them that I do not think you are taking buffalo.
Why would they think we're taking buffalo?
Because the cows are black.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I guess from a distance someone might think that. But they would have to think they're awfully small buffalo.
Duhate thinks you are stealing buffalo. I told him I do not think so, but he would not listen. He has gathered many. I think he will make war with you soon.
Make war with us? Ashki, are you telling me we're going to be attacked by Indians?
I think this is so.
How many?
15.
Where will they be?
At the place of the Yellow Hair fight.
Do you know where that is?
Yes, he's talking about the Washita River. That's where Custer and Black Kettle had their fight. That's about 5 miles south of here. I guess Duhate thinks it would be strong medicine to hit us there.
Do you know this man Duhate?
Yeah, I know him. I've had to pay him a toll every time we come through here. Generally, 3 or 4 cows is enough. Sometimes a horse or two. Which reminds me, Ashki, do you have a horse?
No.
Dusty, give our friend a horse from Moe's string.
Come along, Ashki.
As Dusty led Ashki over to the Ramuda to give him a horse, the others discussed their options.
How hard would it be to go around the Washita?
There are only so many places where you can ford a herd this size. It would add at least 2 weeks, maybe longer, if we tried to go around.
They say forewarned is forearmed. Why don't we attack them before they attack us?
Why attack him at all?
You heard the Indian, Tom. We don't have any choice.
Dalton is right. It's either attack or be attacked, and I'd much rather attack. That way we control when and where the fight is.
But you said that you know him, that you've dealt with him before. As I understood, Ashki, Dohate's biggest bone of contention with us seems to be that he thinks we're taking the buffalo from them. Why don't we leave the herd here and buy him off with a few cows? That way he will know we're not herding buffalo.
Well, Tom has a point. If we can show him that we aren't stealing buffalo, then we might be able to get out of this without a fight. I'll cut out 3 or 4 cows and go meet him.
No.
The others looked at Tom in surprise.
What do you mean, no? This was your idea.
I don't think that Smoke or Falcon or any of the rest of you should go. I think I should go, and I think I should go alone.
Why would you say something like that? What if you're wrong? You wouldn't have a chance against them all by yourself.
That's exactly why I should be the one to go. If I'm wrong and it comes to an actual armed confrontation, who would you rather have wielding a gun in your defense? Smoke Jensen? Or me?
You're not making one lick of sense.
Yes, he is. And you all know it.
The others looked at each other, and for a long moment, not one person spoke.
Clay, tell him he is foolish.
I'm not being foolish, Rebecca. Clearly, I am the most expendable of this group.
No, you aren't expendable. Not to me, you aren't.
Rebecca, this has to be done.
Tom, have you ever had any dealings with Indians?
No, but I have dealt with people in stressful situations. I'm not one who loses his head easily.
No, from what I've seen of you, I wouldn't think that you would. Clay, you know Duhate. Why don't you cut out a few cows, however many ever you think it'll take? I'll give Tom a quick course on dealing with Indians.
All right. Dusty, you and Dalt want to cut the cows out? Pick out 3.
Put a bell on the lead cow and string a rope between them.
Why do that? If you're taking only 3 cows with you, they won't be that hard to drive.
If they were buffalo, could you bell the leader and string a line between them?
Not unless you wanted to get yourself trampled. I see what you mean. You aren't just book smart, are you? When they see you coming toward them that way, they aren't likely to think you're leading buffalo.
All right, while they're rounding up the cows for you, let's talk about Indians. First lesson is, when you're talking to one, look him directly in the eye. If he can't see into your eyes, he won't be able to fathom your medicine. And Indians set a great store by medicine. The stronger your medicine is, the more willing they are to listen to you.
All right.
Generally, the first one to talk to you won't be the leader. But pay attention. You'll be able to tell who the leader is. So when you start negotiating, that's the one you want to negotiate with. And this is important. Don't ask who the leader is. You have to figure that out on your own. If you do that, he'll take it as a compliment, meaning that his leadership is so evident that even a stranger can pick it up.
How will I find them? I mean, I know they're at the Washita, but how will I find them?
You won't have to find them. They'll find you.
All right.
It may be that they will all come toward you, especially since you will be alone. But more than likely, they'll leave a few behind. And as they come toward you, greet them like this.
Smoke held his arm up, crooked at the elbow, with the palm facing out.
That will show them that you have come in peace.
Do you really say how when you meet an Indian?
That's close. Actually, the word is how.
Should he take his pistol or leave it behind?
Well, of course he is going to take a pistol. You were sending him out to face the Indians alone. Would you send him out unarmed as well?
I will not take a pistol.
Why not?
Think about it. If they want to kill me, there's nothing I could do about it. Even if I had a pistol, especially considering how many of them are there and how ineffective I am with such a weapon. On the other hand, if I face them without a weapon, they might perceive that as being without fear.
Tom does have a point, Rebecca.
I do have one more question.
And what's that?
You said I should show them that my medicine is strong. How do I do that?
Yeah, that one will be hard. But you're going to have to do it.
How?
It is important. No, let's say it's vital that you show no fear. No matter what they do, you must not show fear.
Do you think you can do that, Tom?
Nobody can show no fear at all.
I can do it.
Tom, no, you know you...
Rebecca, look at me.
Rebecca looked at him.
I can do it.
Dusty and Dalton returned with the three cows, tied together by one long rope. And as Tom had requested, a bell had been attached to the lead cow. Tom mounted his horse and began his journey to bargain with the Indians. The Washita River was directly ahead of him now. He could see the long line of trees growing along the banks of the river. Ahead, emerging from the line of trees, he saw a number of Indians coming toward him. A quick count determined that there were 10 of them approaching. If Ashkey had been accurate with his own count, that meant that at least 5 of the Indians were staying out of sight. As one, all 10 started galloping toward him. Tom stopped his horse and simply stood his ground as the 10 Indian ponies thundered toward him. Smoke had told him to crook his arm at the elbow and hold his hand up, palm out, so that is exactly what he did as they approached. The Indians reined up when they reached him, then looked at each other in surprise. They had expected the Lone Rider to turn and run.
How? Good morning.
Show fear, white man. Show fear, for I'm about to kill you.
Tom remained motionless, staring directly into the eyes of the club-wielding Indian.
Show fear!
Suddenly, Tom realized that he wasn't going to be killed. He realized, too, that he had passed the test, and he smiled.
My name is...
I know who you are. You are Dohate.
During the entire confrontation, Tom had not let go of the rope by which he had been leading the three cows. He handed the rope to Dohate.
How is it that you know my name?
I have heard stories told of Dohate, a brave and fearless warrior. Because the cattle we are driving are black, you thought they were buffalo. But as you can see, it is only cattle.
I've never seen cattle such as these.
They are called Angus.
Angus.
Never have you eaten meat that is better than this.
Dohate took the line.
You make a gift to Dohate?
Yes. In return, we ask that you let us pass through.
What is your name?
My name is Tom. I am told also that you like this candy.
Tom handed a little bag of whorehound candy to the Indian, and he looked inside, smiled, then took one and put it in his mouth.
Your cattle may pass, Tom.
Red River, December 10th, 1890. They were within sight of Texas now, and though they were still quite away from their ultimate destination, there was a sense of satisfaction in knowing that they would be back in Texas by the next day. It was bitterly cold, much colder than it had been during any part of the drive, even though they were significantly farther south from where they started.
Soon as we cross the river, we'll be in Texas.
But it is later into December than we thought it would be, isn't it?
Yeah, later than I would like.
How long until Christmas?
15 days. This is the 10th.
I wonder what Pa got me for Christmas.
Why, Dalton, I figured letting you come on this drive was your Christmas present.
That might be true. I know that I've enjoyed this more than anything I ever done before. It has made me appreciate what cowboys do.
It's done something else for you too, Dalton. It's made you a man.
Clay's right, son. You've become a man I could work with, and probably someday work for, and be proud to do it.
Thanks.
Amarillo, Texas, December 11th, 1890. Lars Pruitt was a slender man with slumped shoulders and long arms. He had sunken cheeks and a Van Dyke beard that was dark in color, contrasting sharply with his gray hair. Pruitt was also the largest cattleman in Potter County, Texas. What nobody in Amarillo or Potter County knew was that Pruitt had help in building his ranch. That help came by way of him providing a ready outlet for stolen stock. And every cattle rustler between Fort Worth and Denver knew that they could sell their stolen beef there. At the moment, Pruitt was sitting at a table in the White Elephant Saloon, having a drink and a conversation with Red Coleman.
Why do I need more cattle? Hell, I damn near have to give away the cows I got now. No more than they're paying for them at market.
What are they paying for longhorns right now?
Well, the market opened this morning at $4.20 a head. I can barely feed them for that.
Uh-huh. Suppose I told you I could get you 2,500 head of cattle that are paying $17 per head.
What kind of cattle would that be?
Red reached into his shirt pocket and pulled out the article about the cattle drive he'd torn from the Dodge City newspaper. He showed it to Pruitt.
Yeah, I read some about these Black Angus cows. You're right. It says here that they're $17 a head.
It might even be more. And these cows could be yours.
What do you have in mind?
I have mine to take that herd when they get into Texas. After I have the herd, I'll bring them to you for $4 a head.
You're gonna take the herd? Just like that?
Just like that.
You expect the cowboys who are driving the herd to just watch you ride away with the cows, do you?
In a manner of speaking, yeah, I do. From what I've been able to gather, there are only seven of them. Seven cowboys trying to drive 2,500 head 450 miles. That means they're going to be all spread out. If I hit them with, oh, say, eight men in the middle of the night, I don't expect any resistance at all.
This here article says the cows are going to the Ben Conyers Ranch.
Yeah, I read that.
Conyers, as in Big Ben Conyers. Don't you know who he is?
I've never heard of him before this article. Should I have heard of him?
Richard King, John Chisholm, Shanghai Pierce, Big Ben Conyers. They're the cattle giants of Texas. And there ain't a one of them would stand by and let their herds be taken.
It's not his herd yet. I won't be taking a herd from Conyers. I'll be taking it from Smoke Jensen.
Smoke Jensen? Oh, good God, man, that's even worse. Don't you know who Smoke Jensen is?
Yeah, I know who the son of a bitch is, and I have a score to settle with him.
Smoke Jensen don't scare you off?
No, does Conyers scare you off?
I say this. I would like nothing better than to take Big Ben's cows away from him.
That same night while in camp, Dalton was riding night herd when his horse stepped into a hole, causing the horse and rider to go down. The sleeping herd, disturbed by the unexpected noise, came to their feet as one and started running. Dalton got to his feet quickly, but his horse, frightened now by the onrushing herd, ran away. Dalton suddenly found himself standing in front of the herd with no way to escape. Tom was the other night rider, and as the entire herd broke into a stampede, he saw at once the danger Dalton was in. Although the riders rotated their horses from day to day, it was a fortunate turn of events that Tom just happened to be astride Thunder, who was the fastest and strongest horse in the entire remuda. Tom urged Thunder into a gallop, quickly overtaking the running herd. He dashed across the space in front and, without breaking stride, leaned down from his saddle far enough to wrap his right arm around Dalton's waist. Once he was clear of the running herd, he stopped, then put Dalton down.
Are you all right?
Yes, I'm fine.
There's your horse. I'll get him.
Tom recovered the horse, then brought him back to Dalton. By now, Matt and Dusty, who were already about to come on duty anyway, were in the saddle chasing after the runaway herd. Matt was riding his own horse, Spirit. Spirit was fast, and the ground in front was clear, so he was easily able to overtake and then pass the herd. Matt pulled his pistol and began firing into the air, hoping that the cattle would be more frightened by the noise in front than the noise in back. The gunfire didn't stop the cattle, but it did have the effect of letting the rest of the outfit know what was going on. The wagons were about 150 yards away from where the cattle had been sleeping, so even without Matt's warning shot, there wasn't a man or woman on the drive who didn't know what was happening. Matt knew that the others would come as soon as possible, so he kept Spirit galloping, angling toward the side farthest from the wagon, until he was no longer in front of, but even with, the leaders. Once in position, he did what he could to keep the herd from splitting. After a moment, he heard gunfire coming from the other side of the herd. He didn't know who was there, but he was pleased to know that he was no longer alone in trying to stop the stampede. Unlike a horse, running is not a natural gait for cattle, so Matt knew that if they could keep them from splitting up, the cattle would quickly tire. Then it would be easier to bring them under control. Dusty and Falcon came up beside him then.
We have to turn them!
With the three of them shooting their pistols into the air and swinging ropes, they managed to deflect the leaders for a few moments, but they had only managed to turn a few hundred head, while the momentum of the main body was such that the rest of the herd continued to bore straight ahead. Abandoning the animals they had turned, they returned to the herd, once again trying to turn them. The idea was to get the cows running in a huge circle called milling. Since one cow would follow the cow in front, once you got the herd to milling, they would essentially stay in the same place, just running in one huge circle. But so far, they had not been able to do that. Realizing that the relatively few head of cattle they had turned would have no effect on the rest, they abandoned the ones they had turned and returned to the others. The turned cattle quickly rejoined the herd. By now, every member of the camp except for Maria had joined, and they stretched out their line until there was one rider about every 30 feet. They threw everything against the right point and lead, hoping to gradually swing the entire herd. For a while, it looked as if they might be successful, but they were stretched too thin, and the cattle went right between the riders until some found themselves on the opposite side of the herd. Once more, Clay brought all the riders together with the idea of turning the stampede. Then, as it looked as if they might be achieving some success, they suddenly encountered a mesquite thicket, which the lead animals crashed into. Before he knew it, Matt was also in the thicket. He held onto the saddle horn to keep his seat as horse and rider tore through the spines, sometimes encountering bushes higher than his head. When Matt emerged through the other side of the thicket, he found himself in the lead of a long string of cattle. Shortly after that, smoke came out behind him, then overtook him. Matt started to make another attempt to turn the herd, but smoke waved him off.
Let him run a while.
Matt knew that it was smoke's intention to run them until they were tired, so he ran along with him, his only purpose to keep them from scattering. There were about 60 big steers in the lead, and Matt and Smoke dashed in front of them, shooting their guns into the ground right in front of them. At that, the lead animals turned and started back the other way. With the rear animals coming up behind them, they were finally able to turn the leaders until, running in a circle, they re-entered the herd from the rear. As they were the leaders, it had the effect of creating a mill. And now, giving the horses a much-needed break, the cowboys had an easy time circling around outside the mill, letting the cows continue in one endless circle until they ran themselves into total exhaustion. This being December, the nights were long, and it was still an hour before daylight. The riders had no idea of the number of cattle they had in the mill, but from the size of the area they covered and the compactness of the herd, they believed that they had captured all 2,500 of them. By daylight, the cattle had grown quiet and were contentedly grazing, just as if they had just risen. Within a couple of hours after daybreak, the wagons came up, Sally and Rebecca having gone back to retrieve them. An hour later, they were enjoying breakfast.
I have something to say. Tom Whitman saved my life. I was dehorsed and standing there watching about the whole herd running right at me. There was nowhere for me to go, no way for me to escape them until Tom come along. He reached out and scooped me up like I was no more than a rag doll and carried me out of danger.
Good man, Tom.
Anyone else would have done the same thing. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time.
I doubt that. How many others could ride by at full speed and reach down and scoop Dalton up like he was nothing more than a sack of potatoes? I think you're a genuine hero, Tom, and you're just gonna have to live with that.
Now, I'm not finished. I have something else to say. Tom, I know what you think of my sister, and I know what my sister thinks of you. I know, too, what Pa thinks. So what I'm gonna do when we get back to Live Oaks is talk to Pa. I wanna tell him that if he doesn't get out of the way, he'll have Rebecca and me to deal with.
Texas Panhandle, December 23rd, 1890. Red Coleman had gathered 10 men for the job. He didn't personally know all 10, but he knew several of them, and the ones he didn't know were known by those that he did know. He was fully confident that the 10 of them, choosing the time to make their move, would be able to overcome the 7 cowboys who were driving the herd. He had been offered $8 a head for every cow he delivered to Pruitt. He had promised $500 apiece to the men who came with him. That would leave him $15,000 profit from this job. And as a bonus, he would take care of Smoke Jensen.
Where are we gonna hit him?
At the Canadian, Baker.
Have you seen the Canadian? It's higher than I've ever seen it.
Yes. We'll let him cross the Canadian River first, then we'll hit him. That way we won't have to fool with taking them across ourselves.
Ha ha! Good idea.
Then, after they cross, while they're still concentrating on that, we'll take their herd.
When he was certain that everyone understood their role in the operation, he stood in his stirrups, then waved them on. It was a gray and overcast day with threatening clouds hanging low. Storms upstream had made the Canadian River particularly treacherous, for it had flooded over its banks and was filled with uprooted brush and trees. The river, normally no more than 100 yards wide, was nearly a quarter of a mile across.
Whoa! It sure wasn't like this when we came up.
Yeah. If we're gonna cross a river like this, it would have been better doing it on the way up.
How deep is it?
Well, this is the ford. Normally it's no more than 10 to 15 inches deep here. I have no idea how deep it is now.
Well, there's only one way to find out.
Matt rode down to the river, stopped at the edge for a moment to look at the swiftly flowing water, then urged Spirit ahead. At no point during the crossing did the water rise higher than about 3 feet, and that was in the very middle. Once he reached the other side, he turned around and came back, purposely coming back on a different track just to make certain that the bottom was relatively the same.
I don't think we'll have any problem with the depth of the river. If we have any problem, it'll be with what is floating downstream. Big log pile into the side of the herd as it's midway across could create all kinds of problems for us.
Suppose we stretched a rope across. That way we could arrest anything big enough to be of danger.
That'd be a good idea. If we had a rope a quarter mile long.
It doesn't have to be that long. Bernoulli's principle means that the flow will be rapid in the middle, creating a suction around it which will draw everything toward the middle.
What principle? What are you talking about?
Look at the river. Where do you see most of the trash?
He's right. Most of it is in the middle, at least the bigger pieces.
All we need to do is stretch a rope across the exact middle of the stream. I'll be on one end of the rope, and we'll need someone on the other end. We'll hold off anything big while the rest of you get the herd across.
What do you think, Smoke? Does it make sense to you?
I don't know who this Bernoulli fellow is, but if he will keep everything in the middle for us, then I say let's try it.
Tom, if it's all right with you, I'll take the other end of the rope.
Fine with me.
The two men rowed out into the river, Dalton taking a position on the far side.
Dalton, there's a really big log coming. Let this one go.
All right!
Clay, we're going to let this one go by. Let it pass before you come into the water.
Gotcha!
Tom waved back at him, and they watched as the object Tom had pointed out floated by them. More than a log, it was a complete tree. There was good grass here and water, so the cows had been content to stay. Now they were somewhat less content to proceed on. But with Clay and Dusty on one side, Duff and Falcon on the other side, and Matt bringing up the rear, they pushed cattle down into the water. The lead steers formed a bank of 8 across, and the rest of the herd, almost as if in military precision, lined up behind them. That stretched the herd out for nearly half a mile, and when the lead steers went into the water, the others followed docilely behind. The herd was halfway across when another big log came floating swiftly downstream. It wasn't as big as the tree, but it was big.
Tom! Look!
Tom feared that the log might be big enough to jerk Dalton out of the saddle if he tried to hold on to the rope.
Dalton! Wrap your rope around your saddle horn!
If I do that, I won't be able to maneuver my end!
Don't worry about that. Just do as I say!
Nodding, Dalton wrapped his end of the rope around the saddle horn and waited. Tom was holding on to his end of the rope, and he was able to snag the log as it came by. The log was huge, and when it hit the rope, it jerked the line taut, and for a moment, Dalton was afraid his horse might be pulled down. But the horse, after being jerked downriver a few steps, dug his feet in, locked his legs, and stayed up, holding his position. Tom worked his end of the rope and managed to keep the log captured, and even with the additional items of trash floating downriver, he was able to keep all the major pieces away from the herd. Finally, when the last cow had crossed and was climbing out of the water on the bank on the other side, Tom freed the trapped river debris and let it proceed on downstream, now as one great island. With the herd safely on the other side of the river, it was now time to bring the wagons across. Once again, Tom and Dalton stretched the rope across to catch the debris. Everything was going well until Sally and Maria in the chuck wagon were three-quarters of the way across, and Rebecca, following in the hoodlum wagon, was about one-quarter of the way across. It was then that another huge tree, at least as big as the first tree to come down the river, came toward them. The tree was moving downriver faster than a horse could gallop, and looking at it, Tom knew that he and Dalton weren't going to be able to stop it. Glancing back toward Rebecca, he saw that she was directly in the path of the tree. It was too late for her to go back. Her only hope was to go forward as fast as she could.
Rebecca, hurry! Hurry, get out of the way!
By now, all of the others, including Rebecca, could see the tree coming. She slapped the reins against the back of the team of mules she was driving, trying to hurry them across.
Tom! We aren't going to be able to stop this thing!
Realizing that Dalton was right, Tom dropped his end of the rope and urged Thunder into a gallop. Rebecca saw him coming toward her, and she stood up on the seat.
Jump toward me!
Rebecca did so. Tom caught her and managed to barely clear the tree as it slammed into the side of the hoodlum wagon, smashing it into two pieces and spilling all the contents into the water to be carried downstream, along with the wreckage of the wagon and the two mules. Tom rode up the bank on the other side, then turned to look back.
What are we going to do at night now? Our bedrolls and blankets were in that wagon.
The seven men and three women looked at the raging river with an expression of apprehension on their faces. Dalton had merely vocalized what everyone in the company was thinking. What would they do?
All right, folks. Looking at the water isn't going to get anything back for us. Let's head them up and get them out. We need to keep moving. Now more than ever before.
On the Canadian River, Texas Panhandle, December 24th, 1890. It was a cold camp, and because they had lost the hoodlum wagon, there were no bedrolls or blankets. In addition, just before sundown, it began to snow. Fortunately, it had been cold enough during the day that everyone was wearing their heavy coats, so they didn't lose them when they lost the wagon, and they made use of them by pairing off to put one coat on the ground to sleep on and the other over the top as a blanket. Sleeping in such a way provided both the warmth of the two coats and the body heat to keep them from freezing. Clay was with Maria, Smoke with Sally, Matt with Dalton, and Falcon with Duff. That left Tom and Rebecca sleeping together. As odd man out, Dusty would be with whoever was left behind when the night guard was posted. Rebecca and Tom were bundled up close together.
You know what I think?
What do you think?
I think you let that tree hit the wagon on purpose, just so we could do this.
Damn. And here I thought I was being so clever.
The snow continued to fall as Rebecca pushed her body up against his so that they were touching everywhere from top to bottom. Duff was riding Nighthawk on one side of the herd, while Dusty was riding the other. At the sound of the shot, the cattle, which had been bedded down, were up as one and instantly on the run.
Dusty!
It just so happened that in their circuitous route around the outside edge of the cattle, Duff was approaching Dusty. Dusty didn't answer Duff's call, and Duff urged his horse into a gallop, reaching Dusty just as he started to reel in his saddle.
I've been shot, Duff. Damn, I think I've been killed.
Cattle thieves!
Hey, Smoke, Falcon, turn out! Turn out!
Get him out of here! Stampede the cattle!
It wasn't until that moment that Smoke and the others realized how many rustlers there were. They were more rustlers than there were cowboys, and they were able to get the herd running.
Get mounted! We're going after them!
Once mounted, they started after the cattle, which now had a good half-mile lead. The cows were running as fast as they could run, which was about three-quarters of the speed of the horses. But what the cattle lacked in speed, they made up for with their momentum. With lowered heads, wild eyes, and flopping tongues, the cattle ran as if there was no tomorrow. More than 1,000,000 pounds of muscle, bone, and hair, red eyes and running noses, and black hides spotted white with snow. Over 2,500 animals welded together as one gigantic raging beast. A cloud of white churned up by 10,000 hooves rode up from the herd and billowed high into the air, mixing with the snow that was falling, so thick that within minutes it was impossible to see through the blizzard and the dark of the night. Suddenly, a rider appeared out of the swirl just in front of Tom. At first, Tom thought it might be Matt, but he realized at once that it wasn't anyone he knew. Then he saw that whoever it was pointing a pistol at him. Without thinking, Tom raised his pistol. This was the first time he had ever shot anyone, and he felt neither a sense of remorse nor elation. He felt no emotional response at all, and he remembered something his father had told him about his experience in the war.
I think it's something that God gives us at such terrible times. It's a mechanism that shuts down all emotion, such as fear, horror, anger, hate, and love. You can kill if you have to. You can watch your friends be killed. You can wade through a field of bodies and gore without going insane.
The cattle thundered on, a huge undulating black mass lumbering through snow that grew deeper by the minute. Because of the heavy snowfall, the pace slowed more and more. The cattle stopped running and continued forward in what could only be described as a laboring trot, then a walk, until finally the cattle stopped altogether. By now, the snow came up almost to Thunder's belly. In a field about a mile away, three shepherds were huddled around the fire they had managed to get started. The fire reflected from the snow, creating a golden circle around them. Beyond that golden circle, white on white, were the sheep, stilled by the night and the snow which was tumbling down. At first, there were the three of them, Gaston, Pierre, and André, trying to keep warm by the fire. Then there was a fourth, a man whose face was as black as the night, but with skin that was shining in the reflected light of the fire. He was wearing a white buffalo robe, and he held his hands out toward the fire. Pierre gaped in surprise.
Who are you? Where did you come from?
My name is Balthazar. I'm sorry if I frightened you.
What are you doing out on a night like this?
I am doing the same thing you are. I am going about the business of my master.
The business of your master? Are you a slave? I thought slavery ended 25 years ago.
I am a slave of no man.
What are you doing here, Balthazar? Are you lost?
Tonight, a child is to be born. The mother needs your help.
Our help? Do you mean to say there is a woman outside in this blizzard?
Yes. Go for 1 mile in that direction. You will find her, and with her, 2 more women. You must find shelter for them.
Where are we going to find shelter?
You know a place.
What place would that be?
The old barn. Do you remember? It is near here, but the 7 trees that form the cross.
Oh, the barn is falling down, Gaston. There is a hole in the roof.
It is better than leaving the mother outside in this snowstorm. It is the best we can...
Gaston turned toward the fourth man, but Balthazar was gone.
Where did he go?
I don't know. But we don't have time to worry about that now. Come quickly. We must find the woman.
Do you think there really is such a woman?
Why would he tell us there was if it is not so, André?
Maybe he didn't tell us.
What do you mean?
Maybe he wasn't here.
Back at the wagon, Rebecca and Sally had to keep brushing snow away to keep the three of them from being covered. No longer was the trail made by the wagon, horses, and cattle visible. There were no footprints, no signs of encampment.
Oh, Maria, no, not now. I am sorry.
How long have you been having these pains?
All day, but I didn't say anything before. Now they are getting worse and closer together.
What are we going to do, Sally?
Please, come with us.
The unexpected voice startled the three women, and Sally spun around, a pistol already in her hand. Rebecca saw 3 tall, thin men, all with beards and fur caps heavily dusted by the still falling snow.
Sally, no. I know them.
You know them?
They're shepherds. This one is Gaston.
Rebecca did not tell the others how she knew them. That these were shepherds that the Rocking H had come across during the summer drive up to Dodge City.
The woman with child, she's about to give birth, yes?
Yes. Gaston, do you know somewhere we can go to get her out of the cold and snow?
Yes, I know a barn that is not far.
How far?
Not far, maybe 1 mile.
Oh, in this snow, there is no way Maria could walk a mile. I don't know that she could even do it if there was no snow.
The mules. We'll put her on one of the mules.
Yes, that is a good idea.
It took them at least 45 minutes to reach the barn. There was so much snow piled up outside that it took another 5 minutes to get enough of the snow moved away to enable them to open the door. Inside, they found a stall with straw. Gaston built a fire in the floor of the barn, just outside the stall. There was a hole in the roof, and that plus the open door provided enough of a draft for the smoke to rise. As Smoke, Matt, and Falcon continued their pursuit of the would-be cattle rustlers, the snowfall stopped and the clouds rolled away. Oddly, within moments, the sky was alive with sparkling stars. A moon that was nearly full, except for a tiny sliver along the left side, bounced its bright light off the new-fallen snow so that, in dramatic contrast to the total lack of visibility earlier, they could now see for great distances. Red and the five riders with him were now quite visible to Smoke, Matt, and Falcon.
Smoke!
I see them.
Once they get into those rocks, they're gonna have cover.
We'll just have to shoot straighter.
The three men dismounted. Then they pulled their rifles from the saddle sheaths and levered rounds into the chambers. Bending over at the waist, Smoke, Matt, and Falcon began moving toward the little rock-strewn hill. The outlaws opened fire, and Smoke, Matt, and Falcon returned the favor. In less than 2 minutes of fierce engagement, all six of the outlaws had come tumbling down the hillside, dead or fatally wounded. Smoke and the others closed on the fallen rustlers, finding them as black forms in the white snow. Five of them were spread out, lifeless on the ground, but one was still alive, and he was sitting up, holding his hands over a bleeding wound in his stomach.
Oh, which one are you, Smoke Jensen?
I am Smoke Jensen.
Oh, I thought it was supposed to be third time as a charm. This is the third time I've gone up against you, and you won every time.
I don't know you.
Their name is Red Coleman.
You're the one who tried to hold up the cattle train.
Yeah, and the train before that. Oh, my gut hurts. I reckon I'm a goner, ain't I?
I reckon so.
Smoke turned and walked back toward his horse.
Wait a minute. You're walking away just like that? Where are you going?
To get my cows back.
You're just going to leave me out here to die?
Yeah, I am.
Can't leave me here like this, you son of a bitch! Oh, come back here! Come back here, do you hear me? Bastard! Bastard!
With the cows no longer moving, but standing merely as one black mass against the snow, and the snowfall stopped, Tom was no longer disoriented. He could see Duff, Clay, and Dalton on the opposite side of the herd from him. He rode up to them.
Where are the others?
Smoke, Matt, and Falcon went after the outlaws. Dusty is dead.
Dusty is dead? Oh. I hate that.
When Smoke, Matt, and Falcon returned, they found the cattle standing in place. Clay, Duff, Dalton, and Tom were all together.
The outlaws?
We won't be having any more trouble with them. Good to see you, Tom. I was afraid we might have lost you as well as Duff.
I was on the other side of the herd.
The cattle aren't going anywhere, at least not for the rest of the night. But some of us need to get back to the camp. I don't feel good about leaving the women there alone.
How far do you think we've come?
4, maybe 5 miles.
Clay, why don't you, Smoke, and maybe Tom go back to check on the women? Like you said, these cows aren't going to go anywhere tonight. Duff, Dalton, and I can bring them back in tomorrow morning.
Good idea, Smoke. Tom, let's go back. That is, if we can find our way back.
At first, they couldn't even see the wagon when they approached what had been the camp. Then Smoke pointed to a hillock of snow to which a mule was attached. As they drew closer, they saw that it was indeed a wagon, though the snow completely covered the wheels and the wagon seat. Only the arched canvas protruded from the snow, but the canvas was white, so that upon first sight, even it appeared to be snow. A single mule stood beside it, only the top of its body and its head and neck clear of the snow.
Oh, where are the women? Maria! Maria!
One of the mules is gone. Maybe they went off looking for shelter.
The baby! I'm worried about the baby!
The baby? What baby?
Maria is pregnant.
Wait a minute. How did you know that? She's been keeping it covered up.
I don't mean this as a criticism, Clay, but what is she doing here if she's pregnant?
She didn't want to stay home alone. The baby isn't due until February.
She's much further along than that. I'd say she's due within another week or two at the latest.
Oh my God! She may be having a baby somewhere right now. We gotta find her. Smoke, I've heard that you're the best tracker there is. Please find them.
The snow has everything covered up. I don't know. That would only be a guess.
At that moment, they saw a rider approaching the camp, and Clay, thinking he might be another thief, fired at him. But the rider made no attempt to dodge the bullet. Instead, he kept coming as if nothing had happened. Clay started to shoot again, but Smoke held out his hand. When the rider got close enough, they saw that he was a black man wearing a white buffalo robe.
Are you gentlemen looking for three ladies?
Yes. Yes. Do you know where they are?
I know where they are. If you will follow me, I can lead you to them.
Who are you?
My name is Balthazar. Follow me. You are needed.
Is something wrong?
You are needed.
Balthazar led them on, his horse easily breaking a path through the snow so that the others could follow. After no more than 15 minutes, they saw a column of white smoke and rising, glowing red sparks making a beacon against the dark sky, leading them on until they reached a partially collapsed barn. Three men came out of the barn to meet them.
Are there women here?
Yes, they are in the barn.
Who are you?
My name is Gaston.
Clay Ramsey. Go inside quickly. Your wife needs you.
Without stopping to wonder how Balthazar knew his name, or even how he knew that Maria was his wife, Clay hurried inside. In the light of the same fire that had sent up the beacon of sparks, he saw Maria lying on a bed of straw. Sally was on one side of her and Rebecca on the other, both holding her hands, and both with very worried looks on their faces.
Maria, are you all right?
She is going to have a baby, but she is having a very hard time. The baby is trying to come out backwards.
A breech.
The mother and her baby need your help, Dr. Whitman.
The others looked first at Balthazar, then at Tom.
Tom, why did he call you Dr. Whitman?
Because I am. That is, I used to be a doctor.
You know what she needs, Doctor.
No, I don't.
Yes, you know.
All right. She needs a cesarean. Are you happy now? She needs a cesarean, but I can't do it. In a stable, it's impossible.
Yes, you can. I know that you have the skill that is needed.
If you know that much about me, then you know what happened, why I can't do this.
You are concerned, Dr. Whitman, because you lost your wife, Martha, and the child. But I say this to you. Have no fear, for you will do this thing, and it will be good.
No, I will not. I cannot.
Tom, if you really are a doctor, you can't just turn your back on Maria when she needs you so.
You don't understand, Rebecca. I'm not a doctor anymore. Not since I killed my wife and child.
Tom, please, I beg of you. If you can do something, you must help her.
Didn't you hear what I said, Clay? I can't do it. This requires a cesarean, and I killed my wife and child trying to do a cesarean. That is a very difficult and invasive operation that fails 85% of the time. And that is under the very best of conditions. If I were to try such a procedure here in a barn in unsterile conditions and without the proper equipment, it would be little more than murder.
Try, Doctor, please try. For God's sake, you must help her.
Yes, Doctor. For God's sake, you must help her.
I will assist you, Doctor.
Tom put his hands to his temples and pressed hard, as if by doing so he could make all this go away.
Tom, you can do it. I know you can do it.
Tom lowered his hands and looked at Maria, who was now in great pain. The look on his face evolved through several expressions, from anger at being put in this position, to fear, to remorse, to resignation, and finally, to determination. And once his face showed his determination, he was overtaken by a calm demeanor. As of now, he was obviously in charge.
I will need a knife. A sharp knife.
Smoke, you have a knife?
It's a bowie knife, hardly what you would call a surgical instrument.
I've seen you skin many an animal with that knife. You keep it as sharp as a razor.
Will this do, Doctor?
It will have to do. Take the blade over there and hold it in the fire for about a minute. I'm going to have to sew the wound closed afterward. Clay, do you still have that saddle needle you have for sewing up leather?
Yeah, but the only thing I have for lacing are rawhide strips.
The last time I was in town, I picked up some spare guitar strings for Dusty, and I never got around to giving them to him. They're gut strings that will work perfectly.
Rebecca, look in my saddlebags. The E-string should work. That's the smallest string.
All right.
Oh, and you will also find a half a bottle of scotch in there. Bring it as well. I'll need an antiseptic.
Tom pulled his pistol, emptied all the cartridges, then handed it to Smoke.
Smoke, put the barrel in the fire. The barrel only. Leave the handle out so you can pick it up when I need it. I will need the barrel to be very hot.
All right.
Also, I'll need some hot water. We can use snow, but I don't know what to put it in.
I have a bucket.
Good. That will work. Fill the bucket with clean snow and start heating the water. I'll need some rags for cleaning and something to wrap the baby in when it's born.
Saddle blanket?
Yes, but that won't do for cleaning up the baby. And we'll need some kind of cloth between the baby's skin and the blanket.
How about petticoats? All three of us are wearing petticoats.
I won't need Maria's, but I will need both of yours.
Nodding, Rebecca and Sally got up, walked into the next stall where, with the action concealed by the wall of the stall, they removed their petticoats and brought them back.
Rip them into several strips.
A moment later, Tom had everything he needed, and he was ready to begin. He stood there for a moment, looking at Maria, his face glowing gold in the warming fire. As Rebecca stared at him, she did not see hesitancy, fear, nor doubt. She saw a quiet summoning of resolve.
Maria, I don't have anything for an anesthetic. I'm sorry. This is going to be very painful, but it has to be done.
Oh, it can be more painful than it is now.
I can help.
How can you help?
I can help.
Balthazar put his hand on Maria's stomach and closed his eyes for a moment. His lips moved as if he was speaking, but he wasn't speaking aloud. The others looked at Balthazar in confused curiosity.
What are you doing?
Go ahead, doctor. She does not feel pain now.
He is right. The pain has gone.
Tom picked up the knife, then positioned it just over where he was going to make the incision. He held it there for a moment, then he pulled the knife up and looked at Rebecca.
I can't do this. I can't kill Martha all over again.
You can do it, Tom. I know you can. I don't have the slightest doubt.
Clay, you do understand the risk, do you not? You are putting a lot of trust in me, and I'm not sure I warrant that trust.
Tom, in the short time I've known you, I've never known anyone that I trusted more.
Clay crossed himself and said a quick silent prayer. The others waited, each of them saying their own prayers. Tom nodded, then, using Smoke's knife, made the cut. Immediately, blood began to ooze out of the cut.
Rebecca, pour some whiskey on the wound and wipe away some of the blood. Smoke, hand me my pistol.
Rebecca did as instructed, and taking the pistol from Smoke, Tom used the hot barrel to cauterize the blood vessels and stop the bleeding. Then he continued with the cut, carving through the fat and muscle and making an incision in the uterus. All the while he was operating, Tom continued to look up at Maria's eyes for any sign of shock, such as a dazed or disoriented look. Amazingly, her eyes were clear and her demeanor calm. Then, with everything opened up, he reached in to pull the baby out. It was a boy, and cutting the umbilical cord, he slapped it on the backside.
Welcome to Texas, little fella.
Tom handed the baby to Rebecca.
If the water is warm enough, clean the baby, but hold back some of the cloth to put between the baby's skin and the saddle blanket.
All right.
I've got the swaddling cloth ready.
Tom tied off the umbilical cord, then he began sewing up the cuts. First the uterus, then the muscle tissue, and finally the skin. When he was finished, he looked up and saw Rebecca putting the baby, now clean and wrapped in the blanket, in Maria's arms. And while she should be in great pain and near shock, she was anything but. He saw on her face the most angelic smile he had ever seen.
You did it, Doctor. I knew you could.
I'm still Tom. Maria, are you not in any discomfort?
No, Doctor.
Did you feel no pain during that at all?
I felt no pain.
Tom looked around for Balthazar.
How did you do that? That's a trick I'd like to...
Balthazar wasn't there.
What happened to Balthazar?
I don't know. I didn't see him go.
Smoke walked over to the door of the barn and looked outside.
His horse is gone. Funny, he didn't stay around long enough to see that the baby was born.
I have an idea that he knows.
How?
I don't know. How did he do anything?
Oh!
Rebecca examined her locket watch by the light of the fire.
It is after midnight. Today is Christmas. Oh, Clay, isn't it wonderful? Our baby is a Christmas baby. We will name him after my father. We will call him Emmanuel.
Live Oaks Ranch, March 15th, 1891. Big Ben Conyers stood out in the little cemetery that had grown up on his ranch. Behind him, he could hear the people gathered for the celebration of the upcoming wedding. But for now, he was communing with his old friend Dusty.
I wish you could be here for this, Dusty. You were one of the first people to tell me that Tom Whitman was a good man. I should have listened to you earlier. I would have saved a lot of time and a lot of heartbreak.
Pa? Pa? They're going to be starting the wedding soon.
Well, now, we sure don't want to miss that, do we?
No, sir. We sure don't.
The parlor of the big house was decorated with blue bonnets, tulips, jonquils, hyacinth, and greenery. All the furniture had been removed from the parlor so that additional chairs could be brought in. There were several rows of chairs, and they were placed in the shape of a fan, with an aisle through the middle. Every ranch hand was present for the wedding, the cowboys pulling at the discomfort of unaccustomed collars and ties. Neighboring ranchers and friends and business acquaintances from town were there as well. Also present, having come by train from Boston, were Tom's parents, Dr. Thomas Royal Whitman and his wife, Caroline. Duff McAllister had come back from Chugwater, bringing Megan Parker with him this time. Falcon was here as well, and so were Smoke, Sally, and Matt. Duff was wearing the kilt of the Black Watch, complete with the ceremonial knife tucked into the right stocking, with only the pommel visible. He was also wearing the Victoria Cross, Great Britain's highest award for bravery. Tom, wearing a tuxedo, stood in front next to the priest as Sally, Maria, Megan Parker, and Candy processed up the aisle, along with Smoke, Clay, Falcon, and Dalton. Rebecca had asked Candy, her friend from the Lucky Chance in Dodge City, to be her maid of honor, and Tom had asked Dalton to be his best man. When Rebecca reached the front, Tom turned, and they both faced the priest. In his opening remarks, the priest issued the charge that if anyone present, or either of them, knew any impediment as to why they may not be married, they should confess it now. With no impediment spoken, the priest turned to Tom.
Wilt thou have this woman to thy wedded wife, to live together after God's ordinance in the holy estate of matrimony? Wilt thou love her, comfort her, honor and keep her in sickness and in health, and forsaken all others, keep thee only unto her, so long as ye both shall live?
I will.
The priest turned to Rebecca.
Wilt thou have this man to thy wedded husband, to live together after God's ordinance in the holy estate of matrimony? Wilt thou obey him and serve him, love, honor, and keep him in sickness and in health, and forsaken all others, keep thee only unto him, so long as ye both shall live?
I will.
Who giveth this woman to be married to this man?
I do, with great pride and immense joy.
With a big, proud smile on his face, Big Ben placed Rebecca's hand in Tom's. Then he withdrew to sit next to Julia, who was wiping away tears. Tom and Rebecca then faced each other and, repeating after the priest, declared to take each other as husband and wife according to God's holy ordinance.
Who has the ring?
I do.
Dalton stepped forward to hand the ring to Tom. Tom slipped the ring onto Rebecca's finger.
With this ring, I thee wed.
For as much as Tom and Rebecca have consented together in holy wedlock, and have witnessed the same before God and this company, I pronounce that they are man and wife. The bride and groom may kiss.
Tom and Rebecca sealed their marriage and their love with a kiss. Then, amidst the applause of those gathered, hurried from the parlor into the living room where the reception was to be held. Here, too, all the furniture had been moved out, and at the back wall was a long table covered with a white linen cloth. A huge wedding cake sat at one end of the table, and a large punch bowl was at the other. Above the table, on the wall, was a long painted banner. Congratulations to Dr. and Mrs. Tom Whitman. Tom and Rebecca cut the cake, then fed each other a piece, then Maria began serving the others. As the reception continued, many of the guests came by to talk to the guests of honor.
I have to tell you, Tom, that when you first showed up, I didn't have any idea what kind of cowboy you would be. But you turned out to be as good as any cowhand I've ever been around. And I've been around some good ones, including Dusty. So if you ever get tired of being a doctor and want a ranch again, you'll always be welcome at Live Oaks.
I wish Dusty and Moe could have been here for this. Dusty was here from the time I was a very young girl. He was something special.
Moe was, too. I guess you could say that Moe was my best friend.
Let's have a drink to him. Wait, I'll get everyone's attention and we'll all drink to him. Ladies and gents, as most of you know, we lost two good men bringing in the cattle down from Dodge. I'm talking about Dusty McNally and Moe Coffey. I know that they would have given anything in the world to be here now and see these two get married. So if you don't mind, I'd like you all to raise your cups so we could have a drink to them. Then maybe take just a minute to think about them.
Everyone raised their cups.
To Dusty and Moe.
To Dusty and Moe!
A while later, Dr. Thomas Royal Whitman, Tom's father, came over to talk to the bride and groom.
You're sure now, Tom, that you don't want to come back to Boston to practice? I know the chief of surgeons at Mass General, and I'm pretty sure I can get your old position back.
Since you are the chief of surgeons there, I'm sure you can. But I like it here in Fort Worth. I only hung out my shingle 2 months ago, and I already have built up a pretty good practice.
But son, Texas? You're giving up Boston for Texas?
Tom recalled something that someone had told him on the train the first day he came to Texas.
Well, mister, I'll tell you true. You ain't gonna find any place better than Texas. And any place in Texas you decide to stop is better than any place else.
What?
Tom put his arm around Rebecca and pulled her closer to him.
This is where I want to be, Dad. And this is where I intend to stay.
Then I won't try and talk you out of it. But when the children start coming, you won't forget about your mother and me up in Boston, will you?
I won't let him forget, Dad.
I saw the baby you delivered in the barn on Christmas Eve. What a beautiful child he is.
It wasn't Christmas Eve. It was Christmas morning. Emmanuel is a true Christmas gift.
I'm proud of you, son. I don't know of another surgeon in the country who could have done that.
I had help.
I know. You had Rebecca and the others with you.
No.
Tom pointed up.
When I say I had help, I mean, I had help.
Lone Star Christmas is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2011, William W. Johnstone. Production copyright 2011, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Published by arrangement with the Kensington Publishing Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Mort Shelby, Kimberly Gilbert, Thomas Keegan, Nanette Savard, James Lewis, Lily Beacon, Tim Getman, Drew Copus, Tim Carlin, Elizabeth Jernigan, David Coyne, Richard Rowan, Stephen Carpenter, James Konacek, Karen Novak, Ken Jackson, Christopher Graybill, Terrence Aselford, Joe Brack, Thomas Penny, Eric Messner, Christopher Sheeran, Dylan Lynch, M.J. Casey, and Johann Detweiler. Directed by Johann Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Dwayne Beeman. Book adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Lone Star Christmas, read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com and be sure to look for William W. Johnstone's The First Mountain Man, The Last Mountain Man, Blood Bond, The Last Gunfighter, Eagles and Sidewinder series, as well as Ralph Compton's Trail of the Gunfighter series, all available in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloads and podcasts. Now keep listening for exciting previews of other titles in graphic audio.
Where'd he get him?
Before he passed out, Hurley said he got him twice. Once in the leg and once in the neck.
When Smoke's friend and longtime foreman Pearly is bitten by a deadly mountain rattler, Smoke must venture into a dodgy gold rush city known as Payday.
What's wrong with your friend? He shot or something?
No, he's been snake bit real bad. We came here looking for a doctor.
The nearest real doctor's up in Pueblo, about 50 miles from here.
Damn.
I bet we do got us a dentist. And he takes care of most of our doctoring when we need it.
But when Smoke gets Pearly the only aid he can find, he crosses paths with someone from his past. Someone hell-bent on revenge.
How long you gonna let this Jensen thing distract you, Buck? Every day you sit around here messing around with this Pearly character trying to get to Jensen, we're losing money.
I'm gonna do whatever it takes to first make Jensen's life a living hell, Jeb, and then I'm gonna kill him. If you don't like it, there ain't nothing you can do about it.
But the only thing this oily varmint didn't count on was Smoke Jensen's boiling, unstoppable wrath.
Now, I don't know what you have against me, Tolliver, or why you've gone to so much trouble to hurt my friend, but I'll find out sooner or later, and we'll have a reckoning, you and me. You do know, don't you, Buck, that only one of us is leaving this town alive.
The streets run red in The Mountain Man number 32, Wrath of the Mountain Man. Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.